Our next speaker is Daniel Bryan, representing the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who has been awarded the other distinction this year. And I think there is no need to introduce Electronic Frontier Foundation here in this context. And the decision to award a distinction to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they found that your work, the work of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is setting the ground for all these other communities which have popped up during the last years. So without making the years of preliminary work, all this magnificent diversity of communities would not have been possible. Please.
Thank you very much. And I'm somewhat concerned that I don't need any introduction, because that takes out a good 5 minutes of my talk. So what I'm going to try and do is talk a little, I hope not pessimistically, but about the challenges that communities face online in the far future. And by far future, I mean in the next 2 or 3 years. One of the greatest challenges that we as an organization face is that we try and anticipate what the problems are going to be online for people's civil liberties before they actually happen. And that's so that we can prepare the ideas, the memes, the legal theories, and perhaps the sort of community activism, so that we can attack those points as they emerge. One of the biggest problems with dealing with how civil liberties and the net interacts is that legal and political institutions are either too slow or too fast to take into account what's happening with technology these days. They're too slow in some cases by adapting their existing rules to take into account the changes that the internet has provided. So for instance, in the early history of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, we were founded in 1991, and one of our first challenges was to try and convince judges that electronic mail should have the same constitutional protections as the ordinary mail, that people's letters and effects, as it says in the US Constitution, included these strange electronic bits and bytes, to judges that had frankly not got out of the Morse era. And that's one of those cases where the legal framework doesn't move as quickly as the internet does. And in other occasions, it moves far too fast. And this is usually when the internet is described as a fearful or scary place in which laws or policies have to be enacted, otherwise all of society will fall to the ground. And we see this in intellectual property, and we see this now increasingly in the power of communities. There have been laws proposed in the United States, and certainly press campaigns in other countries, where the power of social networks to introduce individuals to one another has been, I don't think it's too far to say, perverted into an idea that these are purely grounded places where sexual predators exist, and where there are only dangers for young adults. So in the United States, there was a law proposed banning social networking sites from use in schools and colleges. Now, the ridiculous point of that is that social networking is becoming embedded into almost every website you see. I mean, I don't know whether that would mean that sort of Yahoo or Google would be banned from our schools, but it's certainly a possibility. And to fear the ability of the internet to introduce people to other people and to turn what is an incredibly powerful tool into something which should be banned or controlled because of the very worst possibilities that the press and media can conceive for that tool is a dangerous thing to introduce so quickly at the beginning of the history of these services. So talking of history, let me give you a quick rundown of what the EFF does, although it's nice to think that we simply exist and are well known everywhere. We date back, as I said, from 1991, and in 1991 there were very few organizations that tried to address the issues that we addressed, which was how technology, law, and civil liberties collide. We weren't the only ones. I think CCC in Germany has just as a long pedigree, in fact longer, I think about a decade longer. There's also the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, who have chapters all across the world who are dealing with these issues, particularly as they applied to President Ronald Reagan's rather amusingly deluded Star Wars policy. And CPSR worked to try and show how computer professionals could make an influence in changing those sort of policies. But in 1991, there was an explosion of new technologies that weren't being addressed in this way, and that was the early days of the internet, the early days of bulletin board systems, and for our founders, John Perry Barlow, John Gilmore, Steve Wozniak, the big fear here was that a huge vehicle of free expression was going to be affected by short-sighted laws or miscomprehension by the court. So this is the sort of area that we covered. Now, these days, we're not the only ones by a long way. All of that arena is filled by lots of different communities and lots of different organizations. I think every major sort of technologist website has some coverage of what now has become digital rights. Slashdot, Ovomondo, all of these sites cover these in a lot of depth and dig as well. The list goes on. There are also public organizations that deal with this, from the list of EDRI members that if you heard we could talk about EDRI in Europe, these are all digital rights organizations that operate there, to specific lobbying groups like Public Knowledge in the United States, who are sponsored by individual donations to try and lobby for a liberal intellectual policy, intellectual property ideas, and also to sort of protect innovation online, to groups like Creative Commons, who work largely as a communal center to enable individual users online to take advantage of legal instruments that will provide them with some of the freedoms that we're all sort of fighting for. So there's an ecology of both communities and of organizations in this space. So that's rather changed the brief of what the Electronic Frontier Foundation does. But we still exist in that same triangle between law, technology, and civil liberties. So let me just give you a quick rundown of how we do that and what areas we cover, and how also community feeds into this, and finally how we see there being challenges to this kind of interaction between communities and established institutions on the net. Our office is in San Francisco, and we're based in San Francisco as a very deliberate decision. We moved briefly to Washington, and then our board members felt that living in Washington is a corrupting influence. We were basically being forced into situations where we were being asked to make compromises that we felt very uncomfortable making, largely in sort of areas of wiretapping, where we'd be asked to make deals whereby wiretapping in the law in the United States, there was a special exemption carved out for the internet, because as we explained, it's technically almost impossible to wiretap the internet to the extent to which the American law enforcement system wiretaps the usual communication channels. So we got a carve out for that in the law, but in return we were asked to support essentially a law that was designed to encourage wiretapping and make wiretapping easy in the American system. And these sort of compromises were things that we didn't feel comfortable doing, and we felt also that whereas traditional the traditional position is that you can't get anything done unless you're based in Washington, in the legal and political sphere in the United States. We felt that the tools that we were seeing being created by people all around the world on the internet would give us a new kind of leverage. So we moved to back to San Francisco. We moved back to Silicon Valley so that we could keep in touch with the ideas that were coming out, and we attempted to use a different kind of leverage to exact some sort of change on Washington. How did that work? Well, our offices in San Francisco are actually divided literally into three parts. We have a legal part, which is made of 20 lawyers who do what's known in the United States as public impact litigation. Which is to say that we sue people, or we defend people in court, and we present what are known as amicus curiae to judges to try and explain potential legal theories that they could adopt, which will be interpreted, which would give a better interpretation of what's going on the internet. So the example of making an argument that electronic mail should have the same protections as constitutional protections as ordinary letters is a good example of this. And truly, many judges appreciate this kind of advice because they're in a very complicated system and they want to see some clear lines that they can use in their arguments. So that's what our lawyers do. And also in cases where companies like Sony BMG have done something egregious, like introduce the rootkit, the CD rootkit that put in malware to try and prevent people copying their music off their CDs. We launched a class action against Sony BMG in the United States and won that. And we're currently suing the major British, a major American telecommunications company, AT&T, over their involvement in illegal and unconstitutional warrantless wiretapping of the American people and also of foreign communications too. So that's what our attack lawyers do. So that's the legal department. We also have what is internally known but not externally known as the illegal department, and that's our activism group. That's the side that I come from, and we attempt to explain what's going on the legal side, also explain what's going on in the international arena, because we now have a group of I think four people working on international issues. We have an office in Brussels, Toronto, and San Francisco covering these areas. And we try and explain, and we also try to encourage people to take action. And we try and provide them also with the tools that they can use to take that kind of action. And then we have our technical group, who actually literally hovers above us. They have a separate set of offices that are built somewhat precariously on top of our offices in a very high-ceilinged office. And occasionally all kinds of strange experiments come out of that. Examples of this is that we've worked on software that would that people can install on all kinds of websites, which would make it very easy for people not to log. One of the great problems with technology, and frankly with geeks even like myself, is that we tend to be pack rats who write perfect surveillance tools because we want to keep all this data so we can sift through it and go, oh my goodness, look how many hits we've gotten, look what all my viewers are thinking. And this is, of course, dangerous from a civil liberties point of view, but very hard to turn off. So we write things like patches to Apache so that people don't store IP addresses and don't store personal information. It's a very hard thing to persuade sysadmins of, is the value of not recording things for posterity. And also we do things like fund things like Tor, the onion router, which enables people to blog and post anonymously online. And we funded that for a year, and we still give them legal advice to the best of our capacity. So that's our structure. How does this work when we're talking about activism in the community? Well, I'll give you a quick example here of something that brings all of these aspects together, which is something called the broadcast flag. I'll just take a quick show of hands. Does anybody here know the broadcast flag issue? Just me? Good, good. I'm glad you do, because this is a big issue. Okay, so the broadcast flag was a proposal by Hollywood to cope with what they saw as dreadful problems with the new introduction of digital television into our homes. And what this was an attempt to place a... I guess the best way of seeing it is that you have a remote control for your TV, and Hollywood wanted a separate remote control that it could use. So you use your remote control to record TV programs, and Hollywood would use its remote control to stop you. It would be a flag which, when it was activated, it would be part of the data flow of digital bits that would come with digital TV. Your equipment would be obliged to stop recording to normal plain data that you could store on hard drives, pass to your friends, back up onto DVDs, or remix or edit as you needed to do, and as copyright law permits you to do. This was something that the entertainment history industry tried to introduce in what has become a very classic way, which is by dominating standards committees. Standard committees working on how digital TV works would form. Hollywood lawyers would make Hollywood lawyer noises about how they should be involved as valuable content producers. And technology companies, eager to get hold of some of that valuable content to sell their new equipment, would invite them onto the standards boards. And thereafter, Hollywood lawyers would attempt to dominate things which ostensibly should be just a technical discussion of the best options from a technology point of view into policy discussions about how that technology should be used. And just to give you an idea about how ridiculous that sort of discussion becomes, this attempts in the European equivalent of this, which the EFF was also involved in, ended up including discussions about what a family is, because the MPAA wanted something whereby individuals could share media, share recordings off the TV with their own family, but not something that wasn't in their family. So there were discussions about how to technologically implement divorce into your television receiver, and various sort of tokens that this would work into. It also became discussions of anonymity. The motion picture industry could not understand why it was a problem that some European groups were arguing that the right to watch television anonymously would be something that should be preserved. The motion picture industry was saying, well, you know, what have people got to hide when they're watching and editing and recording television? And as it was gently explained to them in that context, we weren't just creating standards for perhaps the most liberal democracies, but we're also creating standards for more authoritarian regimes. And there are groups in China and elsewhere who really do value the ability for them to consume, edit, and reproduce media without having a tag attached to them that identifies them to their local government. So these were the fights in the Standards Committee. Standards committees are often confidential. In the United States, we were lucky to be part of a group that we could document due to actually the anti-monopoly laws in the United States that... following Adam Smith's recommendation that when a few businessmen gather in one place, they're probably forming a conspiracy. The United States obliges major groups like this when they join together to be in public, so we publicize that. And in Europe, in fact, it is a secretive process. And we actually had to leave the group after arguing for 2 or 3 years against introducing these controls into digital TV before we could publicize it. So once you do publicize that, the next step is to educate the how am I doing for time, by the way? 3 minutes. That's okay. We then go to publicize it to the rest of the world, and this is where the community really steps into its own. Once we manage to explain these issues, we're very lucky in that our target audience, geeks, are fairly self-organizing and know how to use the tools of organization, and we're very quick use those tools to stop this from coming into effect. What we had in effect was two wings of this attack. The first was that we and other organizations challenged the ability of the FCC, who were the organization that was deemed fit by the Hollywood lawyers to impose these kind of controls over recording devices. We challenged in the courts, and it was shown that the FCC, it's kind of like the radio telecommunications authorities, usually is in charge of deciding whether some piece of radio is going to interfere with other radios. The court decided that that it had no jurisdiction over what you do once you've received those images. So the idea of shutting down recording wasn't part of its brief. So we got the broadcast flag thrown out in the courts. Then the next step was that Hollywood attempted to introduce it into legislation, into the Congress. And we run into this problem because Hollywood pays both the Democrats and the Republicans large amounts of money. And I'm happy to say, although the challenge continues, that after 2.5 years and many attempts, the motion picture industry has been unsuccessful in introducing this law, largely by dint of a very fast communications network of people. We would hear a rumor from our Washington friends saying that an attempt would be to introduce the broadcast flag in a single line in an irrelevant piece of legislation, which is often how these earmarks go through in Washington. And we would quickly email over 10,000 people, and they would quickly spread the news around the internet. And the phone lines of Washington would be slammed with calls from angry and coherent, fortunately, geeks, discussing exactly why this small technological imposition, which clearly wasn't going to win these people any votes if they introduced it, was a serious infringement on how the internet and how digital communications would work. And it worked, and we had to do this 5 or 6 times over 2 or 3 years. And by the end of it, the Hollywood was furious. And continues to be, and hopefully Ronaldo will talk a little bit about this, because their next step, as is always the case, is a thing called policy laundering, which is, if you can't get this through in America, try every other country. And it seems like they're doing it alphabetically, because Brazil is one of the first places that are attempting to introduce this. They're also attempting to introduce it into Europe, and this is why we've tried to continue our fight in the EU. To try and stop this being enforced upon users. So that's a brief summary. The challenges, I think, I'll be very quick on this, is that in these sort of situations, when you're working as a community and you're working to enact political change, I think increasingly one of the challenges that we'll see is that all of these tools are all available to all pressure groups of all sizes. We're very lucky in some ways because we tend to be an organization that picks up issues that the cutting edge, the early adopters use. So we get first dibs at these tools of fast communications, of mass action online, of quick dissemination of data. But it's only a matter of time before every group has this. And what that means is that there's quickly this dangerous war that goes on, not between the good side and the bad side, but between different good sides, where each of them are competing. It's not correct to call it a spam problem, but the communication backlog in Washington at the moment, where Washington politicians are being literally deluged by thousands and thousands of emails, some of which are not even legitimate, some of which are actually constructed by fake grassroots campaigns, is a real problem. So in many ways, one of the things that I hope we'll see in the future is the kind of tools that we've worked to help build our communities, that we'll be able to share them with politicians so that they can help work together with themselves to filter out the signal from the noise and hopefully take on what is a huge challenge for them as well as for us to pick the right policies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny, for this presentation.